Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
You're listening to the Dana and Parks podcast on KMBZ.
Greatest song of all time. I'm calling it now. So all weekend, Sam, I was in the Ozarks playing golf for my birthday trip. You know this.
Yeah.
My goodness. Welcome on into Dana and Parks.
Got a marathon weekend,
Of all the weeks, Scott's like, I'm going to Mexico. I'm like, oh my God, I can barely get out of bed.
I'm going to be recovering.
We were there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And one of my girlfriends, like eight of us went down there to play a couple of the courses down there. And one of my girlfriends said, how have you not heard this song? It's like the greatest song of all time. Because people are playing Beyonce's country album. And the hit that was first released was a different song, like the Texas Hold'em song,
yeah, which is Texas.
Also an incredible song. She goes, oh, no, you got to hear this song. I've been sending it to everyone I know. Crank that in your car, but mind your speed, because it is so catchy. That's one of those songs you're going to look down and be like, oh, whoops.
You are a speeder and driver when good songs are on the radio.
Going 85 in a 65, and I'm blaming Beyonce.
How was the weekend, though? Good?
Weekend was incredible. I am just humbled and blessed and so happy.
I love the sign. I saw that wonderful sign they made for you.
They did an entire Masters theme for Dana's birthday weekend. And congratulations to Scottie Scheffler again, because we watched a ton of golf over the weekend. You know, one of the questions I had about that, when they give him the green jacket, is it his same jacket? Because you know those jackets have to stay there. You get it for like a year, then the jackets stay at Augusta.
And wait, so
it's,
what?
Yeah, it's funny. He put the jacket on Jon Rahm.
Well, wait, then how do they all wear their own personal winning jackets?
Because they're all there. They're all literally there at the Masters.
Oh, and but they still make new ones each year.
Yes.
Okay.
So we were saying last night, like, I feel like I know quite a bit about that tournament. I'm like, is that the same jacket or does he get two because he's won twice? I don't know the answer to that question.
I think it is a new jacket.
Yeah, a couple of fun notes until we get to the just infuriating story of the day. Shout out to Neil Shipley, if you missed this, who plays for Ohio State, completed his master's degree in data analytics, and was the only amateur to make the cut at the Masters. And his partner, if you missed it, was Tiger Woods.
What? That is awesome.
It is one of the sweetest, funniest, loveliest things. And sweet Neil Shipley, like, taps a buddy to be his caddy. Like, I'm going to the Masters. Can you be my caddy?
Right. I'm just giving it a shot.
And there's this photograph. These guys are, like, what, 20? There's this photograph of this caddy. And the look on his face is like, am I in the Twilight Zone? What has happened? I'm literally walking next to Tiger Woods.
The legend.
Who, bless his heart, I think came in last in the field, but he did finish.
He made the cut.
He did make the cut. He did finish.
Did you see Zach Johnson in one of the first 2 days? I can't remember which day it was, but he bogeyed, triple bogeyed the 12, and the crowd erupted when he made the final putt, and he turned around and said, oh, blank off.
It's so good. All right, really quick, from golf to basketball, I want everyone to tune in at 3 o'clock, and it will be the bonus hour this evening. I am so thankful and so grateful to tell you about our guest at 3 o'clock. She has been working for years on a documentary about the origin of women's basketball. And as all of the hundreds of hours of hard work's going into this documentary that ESPN has picked up, by the way, I think 10 episodes, in the middle of all of this, Iowa does what Iowa is doing, along with LSU and all the other women's teams that competed in this historic, historic women's NCAA tournament this year. And it's like lightning in a bottle that she wanted to tell this story about the women who paved the way for us to even have like an NIL deal right now for Caitlin Clark being at State Farm. Like, how did we get here? The name of the documentary is If Not For Them. And I have watched the media preview. It is gripping. It is so well written. It is so well told through the eyes of the women, Sam, who played, I mean, back in the 1940s. 50s, 60s, way before Title IX.
Yeah, the ones who laid the landscape.
Way before Title IX, who laid the landscape.
Didn't get any credit
for it. And like, I feel like a lot of people listening know enough about Title IX to be dangerous, but don't really know the history that it wasn't until the 70s when finally someone asked the question and challenged Title IX and says, does this have an impact on sports, women in sports? And of course, we know the answer was a resounding yes. And then from there, there was still a long way to go, but man, it took off. The name of the documentary is If Not For Them.
And you said she's coming on the program?
Oh my gosh, she'll be in here at 3 o'clock.
Long time
ESPN analyst Brenda Van Langen will join us at 3 o'clock to talk about that documentary. And you know, she's been photographed interviewing Caitlin Clark for 4 years. I mean, she's
right.
Just been right in the thick of it as all of the basketball greatness unfolded.
And she was a player herself.
And, oh, just an amazing career, amazing history. And, you know, Karen Kornacki just retired over at Channel 9. And one of the things I want to ask Brenda is, like, not only is she doing this great documentary about women's sports and how we got to this point, but also as a female broadcaster, what she has done to open doors for other women.
Break
and
glass,
you know,
ceilings,
I'm an
yeah.
incredible, insane Holly Rowe fan. So we'll be talking about that again. Again, the documentary is If Not For Them. Okay, let's dive right on into it. So very rarely do I just call one of my attorneys and go, I need you, don't say no. And if we can turn on Michael's microphone, because hello, it's so good to see you.
Hey, it's nice to see you.
And by the way, that literally happened. Pull the microphone closer to your face. Your receptionist answered, and I said, I need to talk to Michael right now. And she goes, who is this? And I go, will you please tell him it's Dana Wright and remind him I never ask for anything, but I need him to come in right now.
And I did.
She's like, I'm sorry, who's that again? I go, please just tell him. I wish we were here for a better reason.
Me too.
I've been furious since I saw the email. And we are going to get into it. But first, remind me, Michael, as a long time, like, you are the guy when it comes to lawsuits and personal injury stuff. Where were you when Robert Courtney started murdering cancer patients before he was indicted, I believe, in 2002? How did you come to be involved in this case?
Early 2001, August 2001, I was out for a long run with a buddy of mine, and my phone rang. And it was a client of mine who had helped in a personal injury case, a truck accident. And his wife was one of Robert Courtney's victims. He was crying, told me the FBI had just left his house, and had told him that his wife had her chemotherapy had been diluted by Robert Courtney, and that that's one of the reasons she died. And he wanted my help. And that started the long path towards justice in the civil court for him. We ended up representing that family as well as about 200 other families in wrongful death cases against Robert Courtney. Took the first case to trial on behalf of a woman named Georgia Hayes, who was a teacher in Harrisonville, who since passed away from cancer. And we got a multi-billion dollar verdict against Courtney.
For those of us who in our listening audience who are maybe in their 30s or younger and they're like, maybe I've heard the name Robert Courtney, I want to remind everybody that when this broke back in the early 2000s, and I was a reporter down at Channel 5 at the time, covered the trial, did the whole deal, we just knew that the FDA had swept in over at research and they were taking boxes out. And we didn't really know what was going on at the time. And one of the things I remember even on the national news and international news is that this is one of those cases that just shocks the conscience.
Yeah.
And that's from a longtime media person. You're a longtime attorney. Everyone knows someone who has battled cancer or, God forbid, lost their battle to cancer. I'm sure Robert Courtney at the time knew people that were battling cancer because he was handing the diluted medications directly over to them with a smile on his face.
With his white lab coat on.
Yes.
He was literally taking this, it was a liquid drug, and the chemotherapy came in a liquid format, and it needs to be mixed with saline into the proper
dosage. Yeah.
And it's supposed to be a third of the dosage of the third of the IV bag is supposed to be the chemotherapy. And he was cutting it down to a very small percentage, some cases as little as 1%, and just doing it for money.
And remind everybody, because they're going to say, if you're not familiar with this case, well, why would anyone do that? He said in court, and I quote, because I knew enough about this to be dangerous, but it's been many years. After all the victim impact statements, he said, quote, "It's been very traumatic listening to these people." Then he paused, Michael, and said, "I don't know why I did this."
Well, I know I did it. He did it for money. He did it because he was greedy. He did it for money. He amassed almost $20 million.
Because in diluting the drugs, he had more than he was doling out.
That's right.
He had extra, but he could pay them full price for less.
He was charging the insurance companies and the federal government full price and was selling just a fraction of it. So instead of selling the full vial medicine for $5,000, mm-hmm. he was diluting it and making several thousand dollars off of every diluted dose.
Did you ever think in your lifetime we would be sitting here discussing his release? Because at the time, keep in mind, everyone listening, he was not put away for murder. He should have been, in my opinion. The federal government went after him for diluting the drugs and tampering or whatever it was. He gets this 30-year sentence, but not for killing an enormous number of people that, Michael, even you can't put a number to it.
Right. I think at the time it was the right decision by the federal government. The U.S. Attorney's Office was staring down a difficult, complicated case, and all of the victims had some closure. And it just shows you that 27 years can seem like a lifetime when the sentence is handed out, but when 27 years can go by a blink of an eye for these victims. And so I would never second guess the decision by the U.S. Attorney's Office to charge him and for him to plead guilty, for him to serve time like he has. But the good news is there is no statute of limitations on murder.
No, there is not.
And I knew it, and all those victims knew it, that when his federal sentence was over, he could come back to the state of Missouri, and there's still plenty of justice to be delivered. That's why I'm calling upon the state of Missouri to arrest him for murder and charge him with murder.
Now.
As soon as he hits this state, as soon as he hits Springfield, and he goes in, the federal government is putting him into what's called a halfway house, is my understanding, and that's like transitioning him back into society. And I'd like the federal government to transition him back into a state penitentiary and have him arrested for murder.
So when we get back, I want you to remind everybody just why the case was complicated when everyone knew he was diluting the drugs. He admitted he diluted the drugs. Why it's so hard to prove how many victims there were here, even though we know it's, I believe, well into the hundreds. I don't think we'll ever know the real number. And then how did we get to today with this email over the weekend to the families? It's a form email. This is how this works. Kind of giving everyone a heads up that he is going to be free as soon as June.
Great.
Our guest this hour is Kansas City attorney Michael Ketchmark. As we unpack what we have just learned about the impending release of the person I believe to be the biggest mass murderer in Kansas City history, and his name is Robert Courtney. You can text us your questions. We will take phone calls later. I know there are a lot of victims, family members who would like to get in. The number is 913-586-7798. You're listening to Dana and Parks. Welcome on back to Dana and Parks. Scott will be back next week. Our guest this hour, and our huge thanks on such short notice to local attorney Michael Ketchmark with Ketchmark and McCrite. I'm guessing your phone started ringing over the weekend as victims and family members started to hear that Robert Courtney, the chemotherapy drug diluter, who impacted so many hundreds of people in this community and beyond, is set to be released sometime in June to a halfway house in Springfield, Missouri.
Yeah, and I think the number's about, from what I recall, in north of 5,000 victims who received some form of diluted medication from him.
More than 5,000.
Yeah.
Talk about the difficulty of proving. I know we all know what happened, but how do you prove who died and who did not because of the dilution? Because once that chemotherapy went into the patients, you can't get that back.
I think it's a fairly straightforward case from a record standpoint. Anytime you're selling three times the amount of the product that you're buying, it's pretty clear that dilution's happening. And then you have the FBI goes in and does the raid, and they actually got vials. They got the IV bags, and they actually did testing and showed that the IV bags that he handed out to certain patients, that there was dilution there. And then he went so far as to make a confession on a number of these folks. And so I think that it'd be a very strong case to be prosecuted
for murder. How is this not murder?
Well, you know, and I think that that the case has always been there from the state of Missouri being able to charge that. And what a lot of people don't know, we hear a lot about double jeopardy, but that doesn't apply. If federal crime is one thing. You do your federal time, you still have to do your state time. So he can still be charged.
And I want to remind everyone, his federal crime was not murder. It was dilution and tampering of a controlled substance.
Right, because federally, that's the nature of the federal charges would be.
Your clients or their widows are saying what today? Or their children or their grandchildren?
Just gut-wrenching pain. I mean, when I'm talking to people over the weekend, it reminded me of when this first broke and I first met with these people and they first started hearing about this. And now all of these years later, I had a 87-year-old man just sobbing uncontrollably on the phone with me and talking about his wife and that he can't believe that this monster is going to be allowed to get out. And that it's just gut-wrenching.
To your recollection, did this change the way pharmacists were able or unable to compound their own drugs in a little 9x9 back room where no one is looking?
You know, unfortunately, I don't think there's been a lot of changes that have taken place. I had hoped at the time that there was going to be a lot of changes that would take place and there'd be a lot of additional federal oversight, and I just haven't seen it. The pharmaceutical lobby is extremely powerful, and from my perception of what's happened, not a whole lot has changed there. But look, we need to be able to count on pharmacists and doctors to do the right thing and not to be criminals. And when they are criminals, that's when you need situations like this for the government to step in and throw them in jail and let you know there's going to be consequences.
You know, we're putting people in jail, and we can have this conversation another time, for unknowingly or knowingly passing on a Percocet that happens to have fentanyl in it. Those people are going to prison for one pill that kills someone who has asked to purchase it.
Right.
So it's hard for people to understand, with all of the pain and suffering and death that he caused, that this wouldn't be viewed in a similar manner.
Yeah, I think it is viewed that way.
He knew what he was doing. He knew it.
The public as a whole views it that way. And just because he puts on a lab coat and he's a doctor who delivers out death like that, it's no less criminal than I mean, our jails are filled with people who go in and rob a gas station and shoot and kill somebody and spend the rest of their life there or even go on death row. And there's no reason you should get a pass on a murder charge or a felony murder charge just because you happen to be somebody who calls yourself a doctor or a pharmacist.
You sat across from him. You took his deposition in Leavenworth, I believe. What was there remorse? Is he a sociopath?
I didn't get remorse out of him. I remember I sat down and I was drinking a Coke, and before I opened it, he kind of looked over at me and asked me if I minded if I'd give it to him, and I said, I'm not giving you my Coca-Cola. Are you out of your mind? And then all he did was proceed to plead the Fifth.
He wanted something from you.
Yeah, and
you want me to dilute it? Here.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he actually filed at the time. I remember he had two kids, and one of them, his daughters was getting married, and he had the audacity of filing something with the federal judge to ask to be released from prison so he could walk his daughter down the aisle. I mean, this isn't somebody who thinks like a normal human being. Anybody who could dilute medication and pass it through. He literally had a window from his lab where he was diluting the medication to another room where if you visualize it, a room like a conference room with a bunch of Lazy Boy chairs in there with IV bags. And all of these cancer victims were going in there and cancer patients. And he's the one who turned them into victims. And they're sitting down to get their chemotherapy at his office, at his pharmacy, a research hospital. And he's handing them through the window to these patients. And he knows he's delivering death to these people.
913-586-7798. If you have questions for our guest this hour, local attorney Michael Ketchmark with Ketchmark and McCrite. We will be back with much more straight ahead. And also, like, where do we go from here? Because I believe the system has until about June to figure this out. We will tackle that next, straight ahead on Dana and Parks.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
You know, I wish we were walking down a better memory lane in the annals of Kansas City legal history, but here we are after some families received notification over the weekend that Robert Courtney, the infamous chemotherapy drug-diluting pharmacist, will be released to a halfway house in June. I want to remind everybody, I looked back at one of the Kansas City Star articles, and Michael, you would remember this because you were the head attorney for this. Courtney admitted to diluting 72 different medications over nearly a decade. I will remind our listeners, while most of them were cancer treatment drugs, they also believe he diluted drugs used to treat AIDS, multiple sclerosis, arthritis, and other diseases.
Yeah, any drug that he could dilute, any form that was a liquid drug, he would do it. He was just, he did it for money, and he did it across the board.
Someone wanted to know on the text line, can you remind us how it all came out in the wash? And I could not remember her name, if it was Vera or Verda. I'm looking it up right now.
Dr. Hunter.
Thank you.
Yeah, Vera Hunter. And she was one of the doctors who was delivering the chemotherapy medication, and she started noticing that if her patients weren't having the side effects that they anticipated.
Okay,
they
so Dr. Hunter was a cancer doctor.
Right.
She was
an oncologist here.
And started noticing that, like, okay, and because this happened to people we know where the first round of chemotherapy treatment, they lost their hair.
Right.
They were sick, you know, and then the second time, all of a sudden, now my hair is fine and I'm not feeling ill. And it was Dr. Hunter who thought something does not feel right.
That's
here.
Right. And she started dealing with one of the pharmaceutical reps and getting the information on how much of the drugs that Courtney Pharmacy was buying and how much he was selling. And so she contacted the FBI.
Because the numbers didn't add up.
Didn't add up. Contacted the FBI and helped the FBI participate in a sting operation where she submitted some requests to Courtney and for patients that weren't really there. And he provided the diluted chemotherapy, and the FBI came in and tested it.
And in fact, in 2001, Dr. Hunter was given the FBI's Director's Community Leadership Award for initiating the criminal investigation that brought him down. Without her, I don't know that anyone ever would have known this.
No, an amazing, amazing woman. She testified in the civil case that we had, and just a powerhouse of a human being. And a lot of doctors in a situation like that probably would have just gone someplace else or done something different because they'd be afraid that they somehow could be held responsible or somebody would blame them. But she's a hero, an absolute hero.
Absolute hero. Yeah. For being curious and then sticking with it.
And digging.
And digging.
And reporting.
So someone else on the text line wanted to know what happened to his assets. He had a big fat house. I don't even remember where. I do remember seeing the interior, and I will never forget this. Everything inside was green.
Right.
The carpet was green. And you know, whether or not you believe that that's some nod to his greed and the fact that he loved money, what happened to all of it? He insured? How were the victims' families compensated, if at all?
A couple different ways. The first thing that happened, all of his money was seized by the federal government, and the fruits of his crime were seized. He'd donated about $600,000 to a church. And one of the coolest things that happened here, and there wasn't a lot of publicity around it at the time, but the pastor of the church reached out to me and said that they didn't want his blood money.
Wow.
And they returned the money, and a fund was set up, and the money was returned to the victims. And there was a claims process that was set up way back when, where people submitted claims and that money was returned.
Do you remember, Michael, were there any victims in the very, very beginning who might have been at the beginning of their first treatment for whom there was time to try and go back and save them?
Yeah, one of the hardest things that happened is there was a lot of focus on this at the time. If you receive multiple doses of diluted medication, your body, I'm told by the experts that you can actually build an immunization to it. So it's kind of like if you've ever taken like a Z-Pak or an antibiotic, and they're like, make sure you take the full five doses of
right.
it. Because if you don't, your body can build a resistance. And so their concern was that happened to some people. And so we saw case after case where you'd go in and you'd have somebody who is diagnosed with a stage one or two breast cancer, which should be treatable, but it would progress. And a lot of those folks ended up dying. Actually, long after he went to prison, a lot of his victims ended up dying.
So 2 months before his arrest in August 2001, the pharmacist who in 1990 listed his gross income as $48,000 had amassed an $18.7 million total asset in that ledger. During approximately that same time frame, he would, by law enforcement estimates, dilute 98,000 prescriptions for 4,200 patients. And I ask you again, did anyone ever look back and think, now, wait a minute? And we see this in embezzling cases where, you know, the church, her name is usually Rita or Linda, that is in charge of the donations, you know, starts buying property and cars that don't necessarily match the $35,000 salary. And lo and behold, they've got a gambling problem or something, and they're siphoning money from their employer or organization. Did anyone ever go back and think none of the numbers ever added up? Like, how did he get away with it for so long?
You know, I think that all things considered, he lived in a relatively modest home for somebody of his success, north of the river. I believe it was off of Wrist Lake from what I remember.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like he was, you know, bought some mansion in Mission Hills and was driving
right.
around in a Lamborghini. And he was thought of as a very successful pharmacist. He had his pharmacy down at Research Hospital. He had one out here someplace in Johnson County. I think it's Shawnee Mission. I can't remember the hospital was at. But so I don't think that's what drew attention to it. And he was a very quiet man, very quiet, very soft-spoken. And when you look at the old footage, there's actually some footage of him in the pharmacy that's out there on American Greed as a show that.
He looks absolutely evil.
Yeah, he does.
Absolutely evil. I wanted you to sit here today and say that all kinds of things have changed in this industry, and I guess I'm not surprised that it hasn't. If like maybe there should be a better reporting system for. I'm buying 10 vials and I'm selling 10 vials. I'm not buying 100 vials and selling one. And that's not a question for you. That's a question for, I guess, government regulators. But what is there any good that came out of this? And I don't know the answer to that.
You know, I think that when he's caught and convicted and thrown away, that sends a loud message to everybody. And we sure haven't seen this happen again to this scale. And so, but it's hard to look at a tragedy like this and think that anything good's come from it.
So this is from the New York Times. Robert Courtney looked at the search warrant when the feds came knocking with no reaction whatsoever. They sat in a government car and talked about three IV bags that Dr. Hunter had ordered. Yes, he acknowledged he most likely had mixed them himself. Could he explain why their doses had been so drastically diluted? He calmly replied, "No, sir, I can't. I don't understand it." And this gets me back to he's a sociopath.
Right.
There was nothing ever, never a tear shed, never. And with the cancer drug, here's the other thing, Michael. Everyone knows someone who has battled cancer.
Right.
It's the human equalizer. It doesn't matter how old you are, your race, your age, your religion, none of those things. And yet, here we are.
Yeah. When I was down at his federal sentencing, was in the federal courthouse, and there's literally, you know, several hundred victims. It had to be a flow over courtroom. They had another room set up with a video monitor for people to watch it remotely. And he's there in his shackles and his jumpsuit. And and all he wanted to talk about is that it was hard for him to hear.
Yeah, that's one of the quotes. Yeah. It's very traumatic listening to these people.
Yeah.
That's a direct quote. It's very traumatic listening to these people, followed by, I don't know why I did this.
Yeah, but never, I don't ever recall a heartfelt, sincere apology. Not that it would matter coming from him, because he would say anything to protect himself. But I don't think that he has the capacity to feel emotions like that. I just don't think that he's a stone cold killer.
So if people are listening and they want to do something, what what can be done? I mean, there are several months ahead of us where he is still a ward of the federal government. And then he most likely in June will head to a halfway house in Springfield. And who would it be up to, I guess, if murder charges were filed? Could the federal government refile? Could, you know, so many years have passed, but there's no statute of limitations on murder.
Yeah, it would be a state charge. It would be a charge that would have to be driven by the by a county prosecutor. And look, we've got some tremendously high quality prosecutors in the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office, and it would fall under their control and their decision as to whether or not to charge him or not.
And remind everyone why Jackson and not Platt or Clay, because there were victims everywhere.
And look, I'm not a criminal lawyer, and so I don't certainly want to weigh in on where it would be appropriate or not appropriate, but my general understanding is where the crime was committed. In a situation like this, I would think of it would be something called felony murder. If there's a death that takes place during the commission of a felony, and as far as my understanding, the dilution that was done was he was mixing these in Jackson County.
Okay, because it was Research Medical Center right in the heart of Kansas City. That's Jackson.
But I have no idea. Look, sure. He may be able to be charged in Platt County, Clay County, Cass County. The first civil case was a woman who lived in Harrisonville. And so wherever appropriate is where I think he should be charged, because I think there's plenty of justice that's yet to be delivered to this man.
Our guest this hour, Michael Ketchmark with Ketchmark and McCrite. Thank you so much for joining us on what is just, I think, a very dark day. I worried that this day was coming a couple of years ago when he almost got out due to COVID restrictions and relief. Right. And some of our leaders stepped in and said, absolutely not. He's not the one that you release. But here we are. And I think the victims' families probably knew eventually this day would come. But we remain hopeful that this is not the end of the story for justice for him.
I completely agree. Imagine that. He asked for a humanitarian release because he thought he was going to catch COVID.
The nerve. The absolute nerve.
Tells you everything you need to know about the man.
913-586-7798. We're back with much more straight ahead. You're listening to Dana and Parks. You know, so much about the case makes me so angry. Just so angry. But I will share this with you from one of the New York Times articles. When this absolute sociopathic narcissist asked to be released for his daughter's wedding, the judge at the time, the Honorable Robert E. Larson, denied the motion, noting dryly, quote, defendant would be unable to give his daughter away at her wedding while dressed in a prison jumpsuit and wearing leg chains and handcuffs. Good on you, Judge. Let's go to Katie in Independence. Hi, Katie. Welcome on in. Oops, Katie, are you there?
Hello.
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Katie, and Robert Courtney diluted Lupron, and I'm missing half of my guts because of that, and I've paid for 24 years for medical care because of that, and I knew that they would let him out early because he's wealthy, and his retirement funds have several million dollars. His daughter bought a house up north so she could house him the last time that they wanted to get him out early. So his wife never divorced him. She's bought houses in Texas to be close to him. They've had another kid since the time that he went to jail. Just kind of sounds to me like justice is a little bit slow.
But if it's possible, Katie, for someone to step in somewhere in the legal system and file murder charges, I'm guessing you would be in favor of that. I mean, he's wrecked your life. You are still here, but he's wrecked your health.
Yes.
I just hope there is a way to put him back into the criminal system.
The only one that was of any value to me whatsoever throughout the entire time that I spent on the phone while recovering from surgeries trying to see how he could get charged with just one more thing to wreck his sweet deal is Gene Porter, who was a federal prosecutor, investigator with U.S. Attorney's Office. He was a very fair man and a kind man. And I went to see him about 5 years ago because I knew they would want to let him out early.
And you were not part of the original case, Katie?
I was on the fourth tier, and I had to beg to be on that tier so because I was in an HMO and I needed to be able to get referrals. And I got, I think it was like $1,795 last year.
Wow. Yeah. Wait, $1,795. Wow. Let's go to David in Spring Hill. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just curious. My mother-in-law was actually admitted in the hospital at Research during this time. She had lung cancer and had two-thirds of the lung removed. She then followed with chemo as an inpatient doctor, so an inpatient patient. So was Courtney preparing the drugs that were administered to her, or was he just doing it on an outpatient basis?
David, that is a great question, and I don't even want to begin to guess that answer because we know that his physical space was inside of Research. I don't know that that necessarily means he was providing all of it for Research, but I promise you, if you go back and look at the original coverage and trial and all of those things, I believe you would find the answer there. You had certainly heard about the case, David, had you not?
We did. My mother-in-law had since passed away, and she had two daughters, my wife, of course. We heard about it at the very tail end and submitted something, but we didn't. We weren't part of any of the initial. But, yeah, but just for the girls, I was just wondering if we always thought he prepared the drugs and maybe Marlene, didn't recover because she didn't have any recovery from the chemo and she died shortly thereafter. But
David, I'm sorry to hear it. And you start to see the complexity of a case of this magnitude where there are thousands of victims and those are the ones that we know about. I mean, just Michael Ketchmark's firm represented a couple of hundreds of them. And those are just the ones we know about.
Well, and Ketchmark said 5,000 victims, 72 different medications over a decade.
It
and that's a rough estimate.
It
we don't even know if that's true.
Just defies humanity. And any time I talk about it, I'm just so horrified and so angry for the families who do have some answers and then all of the other families who do not.
And $1,700, that's all you get?
Yeah, here's your $1,700. Sorry.
Good luck.
You wrecked your life. 913-586-7798 is the phone number. Stick around. Our guest next hour, I am so excited to have her in studio ahead of the release of her documentary, If Not For Them, the history of women's sports and basketball that brought us all the way up to this point. And yes, Caitlin Clark. And she goes back decades and decades, hundreds and hundreds of interviews. And we're going to hear from her straight ahead. Stick with us.
Thanks for listening to the Dana and Parks podcast. Remember, you can catch us online anytime at KMBZ.com.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.